challenge we have is you need to increase your awareness of the differences in generations. We have a unique situation that, from all studies I've read, has never occurred in the history of the world.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Jim Pancero. We're welcoming him back for another visit. Here's three facts I think you should know about Jim. One, he is a sales and sales leadership speaker, trainer, and consultant, and he's been doing that for over 40 years. Two, Jim has received many recognitions and awards, including being inducted into the National Speakers Association Hall of Fame. And three, Jim believes in giving back, and he does that by volunteering as a photographer for Dallas area Special Olympics and a musical nonprofit organization. Plus, he's serving as the chair of the Board of Trustees of the National Speakers Association Foundation that looking after $4.5 million benevolent fund dedicated to helping speakers in need and improving the community. Jim Pancero, welcome back to Your Intended Message.
This is exciting. I'm honored to be invited back.
My pleasure. We had a terrific conversation last time. Jim, you are a sales guy. And last time we talked about sales, everyone's in sales using persuasion. However, this time let's focus on the sales function itself. And I think it's probably fair to say that we've been going through a lot of challenges and change and disruption for different reasons, a pandemic, the economy, which disrupts business, and we've all had to learn to work differently. How has sales been changing, and how is it adapting to selling today to be successful? Or can we still do the same stuff that we read in that book that was published back in the 50s?
Well, they say the only reason you use a parachute when you're skydiving is because you want to go a second time. Right. It's the reality that selling, you don't have to be persuasive. You don't have to have strong structures in selling. But probably you're not going to make as much money as you could otherwise. One of my favorite taglines in any articles or things that I write is, you can always sell more. It's the title of one of my books. I just think it's so exciting. It's this idea, you can always sell more. So it is, I have found it's exciting working with salespeople more than any of the other professions, because they are compensated by the success they have directly. They tend to see the interest and opportunity to do it better because they see it's going to directly impact their income. But the reality is, selling has been going, I want to talk about the changes in selling, but from two levels. The first is, what's happening right now? If we look just in the last 6 months, where are buyers right now because of COVID and the economy and all the things that have happened? But then the second thing is, I'd like to share with you and your listeners the idea of how selling has evolved. Because every 10 years, since the 1960s, every 10 years, what gives you a competitive advantage has dramatically changed. And it's what everybody's been doing, but then they move to the next level. I want to share with you those levels because I think that might give some insight as well. But if we look at it, don't mind me showing some slides. One of the realities we have today is we have shorter attention spans. The electronic environment has done that. I used to post 10 years ago, I was posting 10-minute videos online, and I thought that was a short video. Today, my average video is a minute and a half. And if I can get people to watch a minute of it, I'm excited. We have been trained to have shorter attention spans. The average commercial on TV, I think now, is only 15 seconds, where it used to be multiple minutes back in the 1950s. So we've seen this constant intensifying. It's almost like taking a searchlight and keeping concentrating the beam until now we have a laser. And so because that I watch these shorter attention spans have really, and because of the cultures that we're in today, have caused selling to change dramatically. Some of the changes right now that I see happening. The first and most significant is sales reps are brought in later in the buying process. The example I use in my presentations, if you and your family wanted to buy a hot tub 10 or 15 years ago, what would you have done? You would have gone to a hot tub store, picked up some brochures, come back and talk to your family. You would have talked to a salesperson to get information. Today, George, if you wanted to buy a hot tub, what's the first thing you do?
You Google it.
And that's because you and I are old. Old people, first thing they do is Google it. The young people, the first thing they do is ask their friends. But the last thing either group does is talk to a salesperson. I've got a friend that's been driving us nuts because she needs hip surgery. She needs a hip replacement surgery because of all the jogging and running she did over her life. She blew her hip out. And so she's in pain. She needs to have the surgery. And every time I see her, she tells me who else she talked to. I found another person that had this surgery. I found these people that talked about this. And I finally said, what did the doctor say? She said, well, I'm not ready to talk to a doctor yet. And it was like, there's this lack of trust we have in experts today, so that if we don't validate it, it doesn't exist. I was actually sitting on a sales call with a salesperson writing to observe them selling, and they gave the customer a fact about their product. Somehow it could handle up to 100 PSI or pressure or something like that. Technical fact. In front of the salesperson, myself, the customer takes their phone and does this. You're right. It's like, you didn't believe me? It's my company. But it was this lack of trust that's built up, frankly, because of the millennials. Because the millennials grew up watching their parents, baby boomers, taking advantage of the car dealerships and the other places because of manipulative selling that they were growing up in. So they reject it. Look how many commercials on TV today are advertising cars, proving you don't have to talk to a salesman. There's one commercial that shows a salesperson holding a coffee cup, standing on the curb, watching all the cars drive by and saying, you know, you don't have to have that experience if you go through us. There was another one, it ran, I guess, about a year ago. We had a young man dancing on top of his car, and he was dancing to the song, I bought a car and it didn't suck. And it was advertising an online place. I mean, it was just this resistance of what's happening. So because of that, if you're in sales today, we can't assume we're starting with a blank page with anybody anymore. What we have to do is walk in and say, so where are you? And you're interested in buying this stuff. Where are you in your valuation process? What have you seen so far that you like? What do you want to make sure you don't get based on the research you've done? We have to assume they've done it because they always have. Major difference in selling today. We are not the first message on what's being talked about today. We have to then, a lot of times, correct it. I'll give you an example of this. I was one of my customers I'm very proud that I worked with over the years is the John Deere Agricultural Division, agricultural and turf, selling farm equipment and commercial cutting equipment. Just tremendous organization with great values. They sell at a high premium because they can get it because they're so much better than everybody else. And I was doing training work for the people that sold riding lawnmowers in the spring in their dealerships in store. You walk in, it's springtime, weather hits. We need a new riding lawnmower. You go into the dealership. And what was amazing was over 50% of the people coming into the dealership were carrying a printout where they had already gone online and configured what piece of equipment they thought they wanted, what accessories they thought they wanted, and about what price they thought they were going to pay. So they were walking into the dealership and only asking two questions. Do you have this in stock? And how much? Now, that was okay, except for one slight problem. Over 50% of the people that are doing that had dramatically underconfigured the piece of equipment they needed. So if we sold them the piece of equipment they're asking for because of what they chose online, the product would fail. The least expensive piece of riding lawnmower equipment they have is this little it's a small unit. It's meant for small yards. We had commercial cutters, people that cut grass for a living, come in and try to buy five of these, because they thought that they were so much cheaper than the commercial model that was going to help them, but they wouldn't have even lasted 2 days on the job. So the problem we found was that the sales rep had to take more proactive control because the customer had already done research to make sure they did the proper research, because over half the time they haven't. And so they're looking at a biased assumption of what they want to buy because they didn't know what they were talking about when they looked on your website. That's happening with, I would guess, over half the buyers. So part of this is we have to take more proactive control going in on this understanding. Second major thing, sales calls are shorter today. We have less time to sell. If you go to a customer and say, hey, can I buy you lunch? They'll probably say, no, I just don't have the time. Yeah, I meet at my desk anyway, or I eat with my coworkers and we have other things we're doing, but no. They don't have time to sit there and hear about your vacation to Hawaii for an hour or to talk about theirs. The sales calls are shorter. So because they're shorter, we have to be more effective in what we do because we have basically less of a stage to perform on. We better make damn sure we get their attention when we do perform. And the other point is just supporting a customer, giving them great service isn't good enough anymore. It's losing the values of the customer. It's like, so what else have you done for me? I have a salesperson say, boy, my customers are loyal. Why are they so loyal? They say, well, when they order something, we get them the right thing. We get it to them on time. We answer their questions when they call and we know what we're talking about. And I started laughing and saying, isn't that kind of minimum requirements of the job? That's your competitive advantage. That's what you're bragging about is you took care of them. So what? What else have you done? And so it's looking at this reactive selling is just not effective today like it used to be. It used to be if you took care of a customer, you serviced them, they kept around long term. Now they're saying, what else have you done for me lately? And then the final point is we need to make sure that we keep reminding our customers that if we do have differences, we remind them of them. I believe the toughest single question in selling is when a buyer sits there and says, okay, to a sales rep says, okay, look, you're the third vendor I've talked to this week about this stuff. Why, based on all the competitive options available to me, do I want to buy from you? And look at how people don't have their answers organized. They give generic responses and they're not reminding the customer. The customer assumes everybody's equal. One of the biggest problems that John Deere has is showing new customers and convincing them we are different because they assume that any other competitors selling the heavy equipment are doing the same technical function and they all have dealer locations to support and they all carry parts. So the assumption is service is the same every place, even when it isn't. So it becomes, how are you getting your message of uniqueness and value across? Because otherwise the customer will assume you're all the same. I'm thinking it'd be kind of fun to cover what the evolution of selling is with this. So we're skills. Is that okay with talking about how the intended message has changed over about every 10 years? I always find this fascinating, watching this evolution, because about every 10 years, what gave you a competitive advantage was done by everybody, but then changed 10 years later. And I watched it starting in the 1960s. Of watch these changes every 10 years across the entire selling industry, whether you're selling distribution parts and pieces, whether you're selling capital equipment, or whether you're selling services, structures about all of them in the same. In the 1960s, success was had in all salespeople based on their ability to demo products. All they did was give demos and give samples. And the way they increased their competitive edge was their demos were biased. So that it basically looked better than it really was. They knew how to kind of bend it a little bit to make sure it looked easy, but boy, it was right within exacting standards of what they were doing. So the problem was customers started distrusting in the 70s the demos. We can't believe what we're seeing because we found a lot of times they didn't pan out to be, they couldn't deliver what they were promising. So the whole industry said, okay, get ready, here we go. And in the 1970s was when high-pressure selling came about. If you don't see a difference in my product, we're just going to squeeze you. I learned to sell in the 1970s. I'm officially old. And learning to sell in the 1970s, I learned closing techniques. I actually, in college, went to a full-day seminar that was held in my local community. And it was a small town. I went to a Findlay University in Findlay, Ohio. So it was a small college, a university in a small town. And there was advertised in the paper that one of the business groups was sponsoring a one-day seminar to double your sales. And I thought, this is great. It was like $35. I thought, well, I'll invest and see what adults are doing because I was still in college. And everybody in there was in local selling community. And the guy walked in and he said, raise your hand if you want to double your sales. We all raised our hands. And he said, the way you do that is you learn the top 12 closing techniques. And when you master those closing techniques, you will double your sales. And we spent the entire day going step by step through each of the 12 closing techniques. We never talked about value. We never talked about what the customer needed. All we did was, when you're this close, this is how you can tip them over into saying yes. So we learned the Ben Franklin close, the alternative choice close, the puppy dog close, the full body slam close, all these closing techniques to basically, the whole concept was, we squeeze a customer hard enough, their head will explode, there's money inside, go ahead, take it, it's yours, was the basic selling concept. Here's the problem. At the same time, there were people going around the country doing seminars on how to learn all the closing techniques for salespeople. There was also an equal number of trainers going around doing training for purchasing departments on how to avoid the top 10 closing techniques salespeople are going to try on you. I was new to selling, but I actually had a customer. I went in and I did the Ben Franklin close for him. It's a 20-step process. It's very complex. You know what old Ben would do? You draw a positive on one side of a page, a negative on the other, and you list the positives. Then you put the pen down and say, what do you see as the negatives? The customer's looking at five positive, no negatives. If they pick up the pen, you got them. That was the whole pressure close. And I did this and it worked. The guy bought. I was frankly more surprised, I think, than he was. And as I was going to leave, I'm like only 20, 21 at the time. As I'm going to leave, he said, Jim, hold on a second. I want to congratulate you. And I turned around and I go, yeah. And he says, I see a lot of salespeople and I want to congratulate you. That is the second best implementation I have ever seen in the Ben Franklin close. What was he telling me? Kid, don't ever pull that on me again. It just knocked me down because he was right. So because this so turned off customers, look what salespeople did. How did they respond? Well, in the 1980s, they responded by saying, wait a second, no more pressure, no more hassle. Let's be friends. Friends buy from friends. Here's free tickets. You want to go to lunch? Would you like some liquor? What can I give you? And the whole idea was based on giving stuff to them. So frankly, it used to be if you had football tickets, you took the customer there because it was a networking experience. During the 1980s, people gave baseball tickets and football tickets to the customer without anybody from the company going. It was a gift with the idea that if we suck up enough, we will have your loyalty. The problem was customers took all the gifts, even pushed back on a lot of the gifts, but it didn't change the buying behaviors of how and why they bought. So the industry said, okay, that's not, relationship selling is not working. And one of the reasons it stopped working is it got out of hand. In the late 1980s, we were sending out gifts at Christmas to our customers, simple, like it was a frozen cheesecake, $25 cost. And we got a letter from a utility company I'd done major work with the year before, saying our gift receiving policy this year is don't give us anything. If you give us something of value, we will return it. If it's over $25 in value, and if it can't be returned, we will donate it, but it will not be received by our people. That is our rule. And I called the customer up saying, well, gee, I was going to send a cheesecake. Is that okay? He goes, well, that's no problem. Go ahead. And I said, well, what's the letter about? He said, last year, somebody tried to give one of our purchasing agents a boat. So look what happens. The ethics of when is it focused on you, the person, instead of you, the person having a job with the company. When that blurred because of all the free stuff that was being given away, that's when the industry said, no, we got to stop this. So what happened was in the 90s, it was kind of a business version of relationship selling. Instead of saying friends buy from friends, they were saying friends buy from experts. So here, let me do some free consulting help. Let me help you redesign your warehouse. Let me help you redesign your parts counter. I'll teach your people how to do this all free, with the assumption that if I show and demonstrate my success of helping your business by helping you at no charge, you'll want to pay me. What do you think happened? How did buyers react to that?
Get all the free advice you can.
And they were working sometimes three and four vendors getting all this free stuff and still putting it out for competitive bid at the end. A lot of people got burned doing 6 months of free work for a customer on the assumption they were then going to get the application business. And then it was still put out for bid. I mean, it was a problem. So what happened was the 2000 hit. What we saw was negotiated partnerships became a big deal. A negotiated partnership says, hey, I'll do all this free stuff for you, but I want some kind of commitment. One of my customers sold, it was the top vendor selling bowling equipment. And they were selling to they were trying to sell to the USOs of the military, because the USO's goal is to create a home environment outside the country to make the soldiers feel more comfortable, the whole mission of the USO. And so they were putting in bowling centers. And my customer was bidding, but they were getting killed because they were the highest priced vendor, because everybody else underpriced over this leading competitor. And so finally they went to the government saying, we're helping you redesign these centers. We're helping you bring it current. In fact, so what are you going to do about this? Because we're not going to get the business. We're not going to be the lowest price. And they convinced the government that they could sell them a pre-bid consulting contract for $10,000. And with the idea that if the government would pay the $10,000 if this company did not get the bid, but if they won it, they get a $10,000 credit.
Mm.
So they were able to work it in, negotiated partnerships that, hey, if we do all this free stuff, we're going to get paid for it. There's going to be some kind of payback. You're not going to be able to just take advantage of it. Across all industries, this was happening. Then 2010 hit. And when 2010 was considered the Amazon years. Where in 2010, if you think about 10 or 12 years ago, everybody was talking about speed, simplicity, and ease of use. The standard mantra from a buyer is, I can go on to Amazon and get this in 2 days. How come it's going to take you 3 months? So everybody, quality and those other issues become secondary, is all based on speed, simplicity, and ease of use. The websites of making it easy to order and track orders and everything, all of that grew out of that 2010. Because everybody was focusing on how do we get faster, simpler, and easier to use as a competitive edge. And now we get to today. What's happening today? Today we see competitive advantages based on connectivity and information control. Now we got to stop for just a second. All of these are important for a salesperson's success. So it's not saying, we're not saying relationships are bad. The problem is just relationships are no longer the competitive advantage they used to be. So we can look at this list on the screen. These are all minimum requirements of the job today, but they're not going to give you a competitive advantage. It's the ante in the poker game. Just because you put in two chips to get cards doesn't mean you have a winning hand. So the idea is, where are you? Because my problem is, I ask salespeople, what's the strongest reason for your success in selling today? And their answer always tells me when they started their career. So the people that started selling in the 1980s, the baby boomers, they still talk about the critical importance of relationships. Where if you talk to people that came in about 10 years later, they talk about, boy, my customers buy from me because I'm an expert and I help them grow their business. How do you do that? Well, we do a whole bunch of free things for them and then they want to buy from us. And every one of these are important. It's just, is it truly a competitive advantage? Because we talk about your intended message. How do you get, as a salesperson, your intended message across? We've got to do it not just with a unique message of fact that we talk about, but we also have to do it in approach and a style. Look how many websites today that if you go to order from a company, they want to sign you up. They want to get you in their community. They want you commenting in their chat rooms. They want to make sure they give you the information of usage and consumption and help you measure that. Those are all important things that really weren't important 10 or 20 years ago. So if we look at this, the reality is selling is continually changing about every 10 years. And it's interesting, I presented this for years, this kind of evolution, kept building it up as it was we got later. So I first started doing it where 2000 was the ending of it, is I've had very few people disagree with it, saying, that's kind of what happened in my career. Might be off by a few years, but this has pretty much been the evolution, all industries, whether it's equipment, consumable products, or whether it's retail, or whether it is in services. This is the same evolution that's gone on. Interesting and fascinating watching that change that's happened.
Jim, so if all these factors need to be there today, how does someone achieve a competitive advantage?
It's become tougher. There's a couple of things with it. The first is, that means we really need to train our salespeople, doesn't it? The first step is, if we want to increase our competitive edge, we need stronger salespeople doing more impressive skills. This is what's fascinating. So what kind of sales training does your company need? That really depends on where the levels of both your people are as well as your management. There's three levels of sales training. The first level of sales training for the rookies, the beginners, somebody new to sales, is to do training on how to deal with your attitude and rejection. some of the most successful sales trainers in the business, Zig Ziglar, Tom Hopkins, Brian Tracy. If you look, most of their training focuses on that first level of attitude and rejection. Remember, Tom Hopkins said, if it takes you 10 sales calls to get a yes, and you make $100 when you make a sale, that means every time somebody told you no, you made $10. With this idea of just trying to get you over the rejection of it's okay to have somebody say no. But that's the problem, is that's the only training that's done at that first level. The second level of training then is the sales rep matures and the company matures in their awareness of skills. Because look how many companies have their annual meeting and all they do is bring a motivational speaker in. Somebody that has nothing to do with sales or sales leadership, but can talk about climbing a mountain or achieving something like that. Great message. But all it is trying to improve your attitude and deal with rejection. The next level up is, okay, to make you more effective as a salesperson, we need to give you product training and how to survive a sales call. This is steps of a sales call. How to ask questions, how to close, how to qualify. It's the mechanics of how to handle a sales call and be persuasive. So this is teaching the steps of a sales call. The third level, though, is how do we teach you how to gain a competitive advantage and how to gain more control of your account? So if we look, we got three different distinct levels of training, and we can't jump to the third level until we've worked through the first two. I mean, I can't teach you how to play the golf course until I teach you how to consistently hit the ball. Because if you can't consistently hit the ball, there's no sense talking about course strategy, where to place a shot, because you can't hit anything anyway, right? Now, my definition of professional golfer is anybody shoots under his weight, so it's not my sport. But still within this, look at the challenge of we got to teach you first, we got to take you to the driving range to teach you how to hit the ball before we can take you to the golf course and teach you how to play the course. So it's this evolution of process that's within this that becomes how we gain a competitive advantage. What level of training is the company actually going to help you? Because working on your attitude and rejection, though it helps, it's not going to give you a competitive advantage. Frankly, teaching you how to handle a sales call is not going to give you a competitive advantage. I don't know, I've heard anybody say, well, this weekend I bought a car. And the neighbor said, why'd you buy a car? And the sales rep said, I couldn't help it. I mean, the buyer said, I couldn't help it. The sales rep did a perfect sales call. You know, that doesn't exist. But if you don't have it, you don't make sales. But just because you have it does not mean competitive advantage comes from the third level. Now, there's two ways to describe that competitive advantage, if it's okay to kind of go in that direction.
Please do.
Excellent. Unless you have a question so far. The first is, where is your balance as a salesperson? I watch, when I see experienced and successful salespeople, they have a balance of skills in these all three areas. The first area is they have strong technical product and industry skills. They know what their products or services can do and the impact on the customer and how that is going to benefit or how it technically can perform to help the customer. It's knowing what you're talking about. The second corner on the triangle is your selling skills, your ability to be persuasive. I'm amazed how many people have a spectacular product and they don't know how to sell it. The problem is not in the products or the uniqueness of the products. It's the lack of skills in the salesperson because they don't know how to be persuasive. They don't know the structures. They don't know when to ask for a question and when to listen. The third set of skills is your business or financial skills. I mentioned before I did work with John Deere, there was a number of dealerships where the customers had this, the customers thought it was a trick, but we thought the sales reps had to handle it and actually helped us. Where in a lot of cases, John Deere, for the exact same throughput of equipment, you know, for a combine to handle this many acres, same with both competitor, John Deere was 20% more expensive. That we had a couple customers would actually hand the salesperson a blank sheet of paper and say, okay, it's a $400,000 combine. You're $80,000 higher than the next bid I have. Show me how I'm going to get my $80,000 back. Now, I thought that was a spectacular question. And a lot of the sales reps choked. Mm-hmm. Not because they didn't have an answer, but they weren't prepared. So a lot of my training actually went into business and financial skill training, because in selling capital equipment at 20% premium, that was a key edge to gain a uniqueness. Now, what I see is we need all three of those corners of the triangle. We need technical product skills, we need selling skills, and we need business and financial skills. The problem is most salespeople embrace one area, tolerate a second, and completely ignore the third. So the idea is, how do we become more balanced? How do you work in the areas that's not your best area instead of put more work into what you do best? There's a second thing, and I think that can help describe where the imbalance of a lot of salespeople are and what they can do to fix it. And George, I'm going to ask you to help me with this. Let's assume that we have a company and we've got a staff of like 10 salespeople, and we need to hire one or two new people because we've had some turnover. So the question is, and let's assume we're a distributor of parts and pieces products. It doesn't matter if it's plumbing supplies or cleaning supplies or gardening supplies, it's all parts and pieces supplies. What are the most critical attributes you want to look for in the next salesperson you're going to hire? What would be some of the things that you would say?
I think it would be persistence. I think it would be able to work a plan, a likable personality, a person who asks good questions and listens.
And your list is, frankly, right on with what most happens. Whether it's a sales group, I do this exercise in my programs a lot, whether it's an all sales audience or whether it's managers or owners, the lists tend to be pretty much the same. And here's the challenge. Everything you said was positive, but I want to show you where some of that only focused on a few areas. If we look, there are four sets of skills we have to teach somebody to be persuasive. If you want to be persuasive in your job, there's four skills you have to master, and they build on top of each other like floors on a building. The first and the most fundamental skill is we got to have a strong attitude and energy. How do you deal with rejection? People telling you no. With the hard work that even when they buy from you, sometimes they don't say thank you. All this, how do we deal with the attitude that you're positive, you're energized, and you're excited about going to work, and you convey that to buyers? That's the first level, attitude and energy. The second level is your personal skills. How effective are you at the steps of a sales call? Do you know how to ask questions, how to close, how to qualify? The best way to present your products or services and the features and benefits about them. This is all the blocking and tackling. This is your ability to hit a golf ball. Not to play the course, but you can hit it. So when you hit it, you can get consistent results. The third skill is your tactical skills. Tactics deal with process, structures, or controls. There are three tactical skills that are most critical in selling. The first tactical skill is what is your selling process? What do you do from the time you identify a new opportunity till the time you close on the sale? What are the steps of your process? That's multiple step thinking now. That's a tactical discussion. It isn't what are you going to do next? It's and then what are you going to do? What are the steps you go through from idea to close? Now, what's fascinating is I ask salespeople, I'll draw this visual out of ID to close. It's just a horizontal line with identify on one end and close on the other. And I'll say, you've been selling for this company for 10 years. Walk me through your process. What do you do? The most common answer I hear is, it depends. Depends on the customer, depends on the products, depends on the competitor, depends, depends, depends. Does it bother anybody else that's also the name of a diaper? I just find it hilarious, but it's the multiple step thinking. The second was when you got the business, well, let's draw a horizontal line from January 1st to December 31st. What are our plans this year to support and grow this account in some kind of proactive way other than just showing up and doing service? The third tactical structure is how do we, within a customer, expand our connectivity to get higher, wider, and deeper? We need to get higher up to the executives that have the money. We got to get wider to the other departments that are being influenced by what this department is doing. And we got to get deeper to the front line to really understand what they're doing and how we can help them do it better. Those are three tactics. I ask salespeople, what's your idea to close process? Walk me through January 1st to December 31st, what you're going to do, or what are your plans? And everybody says, it depends. See, the problem is most salespeople are like the Hilari bird. Ever hear of the Hilari bird?
Mm-hmm.
It's a 3-foot bird, lives in 4-foot grass, spends his whole life saying, where the hell are we? And this is what happens, the lack of tactical multiple step planning and structure and understanding. And then the final skill, the fourth and final, is your strategic. And strategic deals with your philosophy or your approach or your positioning. Your intended message is more of a strategic question or statement than it is an operational question. It isn't, can you verbalize your intended message? But the question is, strategically, can you deliver your intended message in a way that's going to help you? Big difference between those two scenarios. So to me, I see your intended message is really a strategic challenge of philosophy, positioning, and focus. It's not just saying, do you have the words arranged right? Or are you technically accurate in what you're saying? So if we step back and look at it, what are the skills we need to have in success in selling today? We need strong attitude. We need strong personal skills. We need strong processes and plans. And we need a strong message. And when we can get a salesperson to work on all of those entities, we tend to have success.
Jim, it sounds challenging to be a successful salesperson today.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely. That's why you see so many are successful in spite of their best efforts. I'm just amazed how many salespeople have gone into sales and they had to stumble around to figure out what they were doing because nobody told them and nobody trained them. The only training people tend to get is on product skills and on the computer system. So if you're a new sales rep to my company, whether I sell equipment or services or supplies, first thing I'm going to do is make sure you understand how to enter an order and how to track and how to use our CRM system and get comfortable with the computer skills. And the second is we're going to teach you technically what our product does. And then third, we'll teach you how a customer benefits or how they use what you're doing. But we never really step back and talk about how to make all this work, how to gain more control, how to be more persuasive, especially in a brief amount of time. There's a challenge I can give your listeners to see if you want to test this out to see where you are. And the first challenge is to draw out that ID to clothesline and just ask a sales rep or yourself, what are the steps of your process? And see if you can write down what are the steps you follow consistently. We're not talking about writing down the steps of a sales call here. We're talking about what are the steps to the process. When's the best time to give a demo? When's the best time to give a quote? When's the best time to bring in a technical expert? And when's the best time to bring in a manager, all to help convey your message of uniqueness and value? Those need to be organized and planned. Just can't be haphazard. We can't just reactively do this. We have to be more proactive initiators. I had a great program title that I used to do for my association presentations that was such a great title because it described exactly what needed to happen. Problem is, it became politically inappropriate. Because the title of the speeches I used to give was, we need arsonists, not firefighters. Right? You know, politically, not a great term to be using today in our environment. But if we look at it, that to me was so concise in explaining what we needed sales reps to do. We need them to be initiators, not responders. Look at how many salespeople that have an existing territory, they have existing customers. And when they call the customers up, they only ask the same four questions. Or when they show up on site, anything you need? Anything coming up? Anything I can help with? How's the family? And look how reactive all that is. See, there's four levels of service. And a fascinating exercise you can also do is to ask your people, if you're a manager, why based on all the competitive options do I want to buy from you? And everybody write their answers down and see how diffused they are and how generalized they are and how non-unique they are. But the third thing you can do is to write down, and this is kind of a fun exercise I've done, is what are your bragging rights? You tell me you've got great service. What do you mean by that? What is it you do that defines you as having great service? Because everybody talks about how great their service is. Okay, what defines your great service? And we'll write down a list of stuff. Oh, what do you think some of the stuff they write down is?
Competent people, we get the job done.
We know what we're talking about when you call us. We follow through on what we promise. We carry a wide range of products. And how impressive is that to the customer? Gee, if I called you, you actually know what you're talking about. And if I order something, you actually deliver it. Should we be having a parade for you now? I mean, isn't that pretty much minimum requirements to the job? It's like going to a restaurant and said, okay, we'll give you food. Don't know what it's going to taste like, but you're going to get food. Well, and it's this problem of there's this lack of focus. See, the four levels of service. The first level of service is you did something for the customer, but they assumed you were going to do it anyway. Mm. It drives me nuts. The place I drive a large car because I'm 6'7". So I drive an SUV. And I drive it from, bought it from an upscale dealership. And they advertise in the city all over the place. You buy a car from us, you get free car washes for life. I had my car in for service. I had a lot of stuff being done for it. I was in a hurry. It was when we had loaners. I was returning a loaner car. And I called up and I said, I have a very tight schedule. Is my car ready? They said, yes, it is. And I said, I want to run in, pay for it. Give me the keys. I'm out of there. I have a real tight schedule. No problem. We can help you with that. I pull in, pay for it. Where's the car? Well, it's still in the back. Well, I thought you said it was ready. They said, but we're giving you a free car wash. And I said, I'm late. I need my car. Yeah, but we're giving you a free. He kept reminding me this free car wash. And it was like, wait, they're not doing what's important to me. And now when I pull into their dealership, they have a sign that says free car washes, 90-minute wait. And I'm thinking, this is their uniqueness. This is their value. So one of the things to do, the first level is you did something, but I assumed you were going to do it anyway. So the more you brag about it, the more irritating it becomes. The next level up, it wasn't assumed, but it sure was expected. I just paid $1,000 to have maintenance worked out on my car, and they're giving me a free car wash for $1,000. Then I'd be waxing the damn thing, not just cleaning it. So it's expected, but I'm thinking, you know, this isn't winning me great excitement because of it. The third level is now you did something that impressed me. Wow, I'm surprised, impressed with how fast you got that, or you had it in stock. The fourth and final level is you did something that was amazing. So the customer will tell everybody else about how it happened or what happened to them. What's interesting is when I build a list with a sales team, what are your bragging rights? What are you most proud of in your customer service? After we build a list sometimes of 20 items and we go back and explain the four levels, I'll go back and ask them, so where's your list on these four levels? And usually the entire list is assumed or expected.
Mm.
The only time we can gain a competitive advantage is when we're proactive. If you're reactively supporting a customer, you'll never have a competitive advantage. Because if the customer initiates the request and you follow through, at most it can be assumed or expected. Where if I come to you and say, wow, you've got a lot of hours on that equipment, you need to be doing maintenance, or these are the exposures you have. And if I bring that information to you proactively, now I'm doing something impressive or amazing because I brought it to you. If you have to come to me, it's never impressive or amazing. But look how many salespeople are reactive in what they're doing, waiting for the customer to come to them to ask for something. And then they respond and say, aren't we doing a great job? It's just kind of fascinating how it works. Are you a proactive initiator? Are you a reactive responder? Are you an arsonist? Or are you a firefighter?
Hmm. And I see an analogy there, Jim. It's curious. I ride a motorcycle, and after they sold me the motorcycle, I never heard from them. Like, I would take my bike in for service, but I never heard from them. And they never called me. They didn't, you know, every spring they know I've got to start up. I'm probably going to need something, but they don't contact me. And I think, wow, business must be good if you can just be that lazy.
It is. I think there's a couple of things. One of the things that COVID has done is it's caused a major disruption to business. I remember one of my distributors said, the biggest problem we have is the customer, the suppliers we used to be able to count on, we can't anymore. So reliability, because of supply disruption, not getting what we needed when we needed it, all the stuff still tied up on in the harbors that they can't get off the ships and can't get inland to be able to distribute because they're so jammed up. The system has really collapsed in a lot of ways of our supply chain. It has been disrupted. So because of that, during COVID, most salespeople stopped selling. There was actually companies that said, we will take on no new customers. We're having a hard enough time servicing what we have. There were some that even told their smallest customers, I don't know that we can help you or not because we just don't have the resources. So there was this circling of wagons, the kind of concentration of only working. And all of that work was expediting, problem solving, special pricing, trying to apologize, those kind of calls. So they were really in a lead service person role. Now, as things have opened up, we need them to switch back to being more proactive in selling. And look how many are reactive still. They come in Monday morning, and based on the voicemails they have and the emails they have, defines what they do for the day. And look how exposed that is. It's reactive. And customers just are not impressed with that anymore. Gee, I ordered something. You took the order properly. You had it in stock and you delivered it on a reasonable time and you invoiced me properly. Why are you so impressed that you think that you're now a trusted advisor to me when all you've done is just process an order? It's like I'm amazed how many of these restaurants we do carry out food. And when I go to the counter, I give them my credit card. They hand me the bag of food and the receipt expects a tip. And I'm like, why would this be compensated? This was minimum requirements of the job. I called in, I ordered it, I came and picked it up. I came into your restaurant to be able to give it. I paid for it. And I thought, hell, you ought to be giving me a tip. I'm amazed at the grocery stores. How, if I bag my own groceries and I do the self-checkout, how come I'm not getting a discount?
Mm.
So they keep saying, you use the self-checkout. And I go, why? There's no value to me in it. It doesn't do anything for me. In fact, frankly, hearing some of the stories, if I make a mistake, I could be arrested. But they want me to use it because it makes it more efficient for them. But I don't see much value for me. So it's like, what are you going to do for me? How are you going to help me? And how is it going to be different? Why, based on all the competitive options available to me, do I want to buy from you? And that message has to focus on the customer. Jade Levinson in the 1960s had such a spectacular quote. He said, you don't go into the hardware store to buy a drill. You go into the hardware store to buy the opportunity to make holes. The disconnect occurs in the store when the rep is just trying to push their drill. So it's like, we got to be customer focused. Some people call it second step selling. First step is you satisfy what the customer wants. So the second step is they satisfy what you want, which is the order and a relationship.
Mm.
So we look at selling as becoming, it is not just a reactive job anymore. But I'm just amazed when I do programs, I'll ask salespeople, raise your hand if you have been through any sales training other than product knowledge and computer skills in your job. And over half the room raise their hand that no, they have not. So this is where the job of a sales manager is coming in, because the job of selling is changing dramatically. If we don't have the sales leadership change to be more focused on what the sales team needs, then the sales organization is not going to be very effective. Can I show you what I mean by that? I know where this is a sales program, but just a little bit because how sales leadership is impacting this.
Let's see what that looks like, Jim. And Jim, I'm thinking here, you know, this is a show that I'm going to listen to over and over again just for my own sales learning.
Well, I'm honored. let me show you this visual I talked about just to tie it in this ID to close process. If we look at this ID to close process, how this is impacting a company is significant. First of all, because the majority of salespeople, they're Harari birds. They can't even define the steps. Look at the difference. If you and I are playing chess and I only think one move ahead, but you think two moves, how many games are you going to win?
It's going to win all of them, yeah.
Well, all of them, because you're thinking more moves ahead than I am. So in selling right now, the question is, what is your process and how replicable is it? Because the more replicable the process is, the more efficient you are in going through it, the higher the quality each step will be in going through it. If you're planned and prepared, we don't need painters doing a new canvas for each customer. We need a printing press. We identify and make it look unique, but we do the same consistent process so we can improve the efficiency as well as the effectiveness. So if we look at the selling process, I need to close. There is a critical step in the middle that happens that changes everything. And that critical step in the middle of this process, if you're listening just on audio, we have an ID to close line drawn. Right in the middle, we put a hash mark in the middle. And in that, we title it proposal or price quote. So it's like halfway through the process or somewhere in the middle of your process, you're going to issue a price quote. That is a critical turning point in this process. Because before you give your price quote, you have power. As soon as you give your price quote, you give away all your power. If I'm trying to sell you for your intended message and I'm trying to sell you some computer services, if I haven't given you a proposal, I said, would you let me talk to some of your technical people and understand what you're doing now, what platforms you're using? You would probably say yes, because it's going to help me get you a more accurate price. But if I give you my proposal and I say, now, do you mind if I talk to some of your people? I bet your answer is going to be, well, if you win the business, we got what we needed now. Let's just wait until then. So as soon as a sales rep issues their proposal, they lose all their power. But look how over the last couple of decades, we have pushed sales reps quote early as possible. get the proposal in front of the customer. But look what happens. All it does is take away your power. The next question is, when does your sales manager get involved to help you? And the problem is, the last 20 years, the sales managers have gotten involved after their proposal is issued. In fact, in a lot of companies, the manager doesn't even know a proposal exists until it shows up on their computer tracking system because they use the configurator. And a lot of more senior sales reps don't want to tell the customer, their manager, what they're working on. So if it fails, they don't have the negative. The old joke, if a sales call crashes in the middle of the woods and there's no manager around, did it count? Yeah, that's kind of the old philosophy of selling. So for most managers, but look what happens if my manager gets involved after I issue a price quote. There's only two things they can do to help me as a sales rep. They either cut the price to help us win the business, or they offer a lot of free additional services that lower our margins to win the business. But that's the only power they have left. This is what the old style of selling was. It was focusing on the transaction. Today, the more successful sales leadership showing better results is we need to get in front of this process. We need a selling process coach. The selling process coach, if you walk past them and say, hey, I just got a new lead, what a selling process coach is going to say, get in here, let's talk about it. What are you going to do? How are you going to prepare? When are you going to do this? And be more future-focused predictive instead of today-focused closing reality. And this is, I would say, the biggest difference between pre-COVID and post-COVID. Pre-COVID, transactional coaching was the style of most managers. Frankly, most managers were in support functions up until about 6 or 7 years ago. So all they did was special pricing, expediting, problem solving, and customer thank you calls or challenge calls. But in all those cases, they're not leading the sales team, they're supporting it. What we're seeing is the shift earlier in the process, with the selling process coach getting involved earlier in the beginning when the sales rep still has power. And the coach can still impact the results and success of what's being done. So it's just this shift in process of focus of what's going on. So how do we get better as a sales team? There's three things. The first thing is you need to have a stronger message of uniqueness. Your intended message is such a spectacular title for these podcasts because it's the bottom line of what needs to be there. Because if you don't have an intended message that's developed, refined, and unique, doesn't matter what else you do, you're not going to have any success. I believe you have hit on the key differentiator of success in selling today. And the number one is your intended message. The second thing is you have the best practices of understanding the steps and structures and the tools to be more efficient and more effective. And then the third thing, besides having a strong message and having strong best practices or tools, is they have strong coaching help from somebody. Even if you work alone, find a peer that you can coach each other. In my speaking business, we have mastermind groups because we're all independent business people, but we get together and we'll get together in small groups and we just coach each other. So you might be a humorist and I'm a sales trainer, but we can both help each other in our careers because we come from different strengths in being professional trainers and coaches and speakers. So it's those three things: strengthen your message, strengthen your structures and tools, and strengthen the coaching help you're getting. Look at the case. If I was a golf instructor and you come to me and say, you got a free lesson, a one-day lesson as a Christmas present. So you're coming to me at the club to take advantage of this free lesson that you've been given as a gift. And I, as the coach, say, so what do you most want to improve in your golf game? And you tell me, I'd like to get an extra 20 yards out of my drive. How effective do you think my coaching help will be if my first suggestion is, why don't you try whacking it harder? Right? You're expecting more structure and more tips and techniques so that you can be more efficient and effective and, frankly, with less energy, accomplish more. That's what coaching is all about. So we need those three pieces. We need to have strong messaging, strong tools, and strong coaching. When we have those three things in unison, sales tend to take off. We know you're good. Now the only question is, are you ready to get even better and to put more structure and process behind what you're doing?
Powerful advice, Jim. Jim, I know that you regularly publish instructional, helpful advice videos online on your YouTube channel and on your LinkedIn I believe you're publishing about three a week.
Three a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. I post on LinkedIn and on YouTube. And it's a resource available to you. In fact, if you can either follow me on LinkedIn, it's Jim Pansero. You can look me up on YouTube, though most of the views I get are through LinkedIn. But to help out, I have a newsletter that I've been publishing for a number of years. And the newsletter comes out every Monday morning. And all the newsletter has is the links and descriptions of the videos I posted last week. So I have a lot of sales managers that have signed up for my newsletter, frankly, to track what videos are coming easy and then to decide if there's any they want to use in their sales meeting.
Powerful tool. And you can find the links to those resources in the description below. Along with that, there's also a program you have available online. There's a course,
Jim. Video programs, yes. AdvancedSalesUniversity.com. There's one program on No BS Guide to Selling in Under an Hour. It defines the five major selling skills that you need to be successful in sales and how to improve them. And the other one is called Your Price is Too High, Seven Steps to Defending a Higher Price. Mm. And then all videos are under, each one is under about 8 minutes in length. Both series are only an hour in total length. It's concentrated learning, but it's meant to help you increase your competitive edge, make you more persuasive, help you be more effective, help you make more money. It's Advanced Sales University. I hope you check it out.
And you can find those links in the description below. Jim, as we wrap up, if you could be sitting down with a sales manager and who's trying to get better results from a team that is resisting the leadership or perhaps not receiving the leadership they need, what one, two, or three pieces of advice would you give to that sales leader?
Great question. I think the first piece is to realize that you can't motivate anybody to do anything as a manager. All you can do is create environments for people to motivate themselves because they're already highly motivated. The challenge we have is you need to increase your awareness of the differences in generations. We have a unique situation that from all studies I've read has never occurred in the history of the world. And that is you as a manager could very well have four distinct generations reporting to you. You could have baby boomers that are over, I think it's 58 now and older is a baby boomer. You could be a Gen Xer, which is 40 and over. You could be a millennial, which is 27 or over, or you could be a Gen Z, which is under 27. And what's amazing is each of those groups have completely different motivations, different interests, and different needs. What's amazing to me about the Gen Zs, the youngest generation in the workforce right now, is the average Gen Z has a better credit rating, personal credit rating, than does a millennial. Because the Gen Zs grew up in a lot of recessionary times with their parents, so they kind of came out of as recession babies. So because of that, just like the people that grew up during the Depression in the 1920s, they became much more astute and financially stable because they saw the consequences of not doing that. So if we look at this process, this is the time that we need you to look at how do we reach each of these different groups because they each have a different motivational base of what they want to help them achieve more. The second thing is understand selling has become paint by numbers. The old days, you were successful if you had a sales team of independent gunfighters, each doing it different, each saying different stuff, each even selling different products within your product lines because of what they like best. And frankly, all managers did 20 years ago was just get out of the way of the best people and support them by special pricing, expediting, problem solving, and thank you calls. Today, it's become much more of leadership. And leadership, it's like reins on a stagecoach. Now we need to steer the horses, not just yell at them to do better. And as part of that, selling has become paint by numbers. Consistency of process, consistency of structure makes you more efficient and also more effective. So selling is becoming more of a science than an art. And the only way we're going to make these high performance numbers that companies expect today, because it keeps going up every year, is going to only be when we are able to put more structure and consistency so we can achieve the high numbers that our company is expecting. The job of a sales manager is not to sell. Job of a sales manager is to help their people do even better. I have a very simple definition. The job of a sales manager is to help each and every one of my people achieve more than they would have achieved if we just left them alone. You're the delta difference of a sales team. And to do that, you have to understand motivation. You have to understand the generational differences and the personality differences and know how to be fair and consistent at the same time being flexible to the needs of each of your people. That to me is the foundation of what it takes to be successful in sales leadership.
Jim, a lot of valuable advice, very challenging to for me to pull one most powerful piece of advice in there. I'll end with this comment, the reminder that salespeople today need to be proactive, not reactive.
If you like what you heard, tell your friends and post your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts because that helps more listeners find us. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.